WBAI New York. I'm Chris Bengert Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Greetings. Bienvenidos a todo mi gente escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, January 19, 2024. You can also hear us on our website, which is latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez. And today on the show, we put the spotlight on Panama, where late last year, after weeks of protests by anti-mining activists and other sectors of Panamanian society, the Panamanian Supreme Court ruled that a contract between the Panamanian government and a Canadian mining firm was deemed unconstitutional. This turned out to be a surprise victory for environmental activists in Panama. But can it have a ripple effect to the rest of Central America? Well, that's what we're here to find out. As our guest today joins us, it's Jorge Cuellar, who's an assistant professor of Latin American, Latino, and Caribbean studies at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. He comes back to the show. Once again, welcome back to the show and Feliz Año Nuevo, Jorge Cuellar.
Feliz Año Nuevo, Oscar. I feel like I'm a regular on the show at this point. I feel we covered so many topics and I'm really excited to get into the question of Panama today.
Yeah, we had quite a lot of fun breaking down the Miss Universe pageant in El Salvador late last year and all the shenanigans in between that. So we got some bigger fish to fry though on this episode. So obviously we're going to talk about the court case and what this Canadian mining company is. But before we get to all of those details, can you explain the size and significance of Panama's copper industry? This is not just some random mine or some random industry in one country. This may be one of the largest copper reserves of all of Central America, which carries, as we said in the beginning, quite possibly a ripple effect for other environmental movements in Central America.
Yeah, so the copper mine, Cobre Panamá, which is owned by First Quantum Mining, is the topic that we're talking about today. But that copper mine is the biggest in all of Latin America, around copper specifically. They're lithium ones that are really large. You know, there's cobalt in places like Africa that are huge. But for Latin America, in terms of copper, this mine in Panama is one of the largest. And so in terms of global copper production, I think this specific mine produced about 1%, a whole percent of all copper used in the world, which is pretty substantial. For Panama specifically, I believe that the amount of copper that it produced, or that was extracted from it rather, was amounted to about 5% of Panama's GDP, which is close to like 2.85, almost 3 billion a year in terms of what they were getting on the return for that raw material. But what's really interesting here, of course, is that most of the value of copper is produced elsewhere. So the raw materials was extracted from Panama and that money remains. What happens to that money in terms of how it's administered by the government, right? Whether it sort of quote unquote trickles down, right, to regular people is something else. I hope a question that we can get into. But in terms of like the raw value that that copper mine produced is around, you know, 2.85, 3 billion in like 2021, 2022. And that amounts to about 1% of global production, which is pretty sizable for a place like Panama to be contributing that much copper, right, to the global economy. And especially in a place like, you know, Central America, where it's been other metals, right, like gold, right, like zinc and all these other kinds of nickel, for example, is another metal that's mined. But copper in Panama is pretty sizable. And the idea, right, initially was sold as being this kind of project that would produce enough riches in order to help keep a certain kind of standard of living in Panama and to help people, you know, experience economic mobility, have better schools, better hospitals, better roads. And, you know, as we get into it, we're going to find out that, in fact, this was a sort of false promise, right? The value that was generated from that copper mine really never ended up in public hands.
Yeah. And before we continue, I forgot to mention that we need to give a shout out to Michael Fox, who interviewed you late last month with regards to this issue at hand. And Michael Fox just happened to be on the show last week to discuss the Brazil attempted coup or insurrection right about this time last year. So shout out to Michael Fox if you're listening.
Yeah, props to Mike.
And we'll also create a link to that article as well so people can learn more about what's going on in Panama with regards to environmental rights. And the other thing that I want to mention that you sort of brought up already, that this sort of commodity like copper is not just a precious metal, not something that contains value, but considering the modern means of communications that we have, just to even conduct this interview, you know, such things like zinc and copper and all those other materials are necessary for all the modern means of communications that we have. And that sort of explains why Canadian and U.S. interests have such a vested interest in Panamanian natural resources like copper. Now, let's go straight to the very company in question that was part of that Supreme Court ruling, and it's called First Quantum Minerals. So for those who may not know, who are they? And, you know, I think this is an opportunity to point out that Canadian interests in Latin American raw materials is just as nefarious as U.S. interest.
I think you make a really good point there. Like, we often really think about U.S. presence in Latin America, right, because of the kind of historical relationship of dependency, of imperialism, interventionism, exploitation. But right alongside the Americans, the Canadians have always been there. So like when we think about what happened in El Salvador in the early 2000s, right, around metallic mining, there was a Canadian corporation behind all of this, right, that was actually taking advantage of things like CAFTA, right, the Central American Free Trade Agreement that made it possible for this kind of explosion of metallic mining throughout the Americas, and especially in Central America. And the Cobre Panamá First Quantum Mining Project is a direct result of that policy as well. But what First Quantum Minerals is, it's a mining firm that's based out of Toronto, Canada, right? It's a Canadian transnational corporation. It also has operations not only in Panama, although that's the largest one, but it has operations in Democratic Republic of Congo, in Zambia, right, in other places around the world where it does other kinds of mining. So this is where you might have cobalt, nickel, right, other forms of mining that aren't explicitly or actually copper like in Panama. But nonetheless, right, the relationship of this corporation to the global south is one of exploring for these kinds of extractive opportunities and then arranging contracts and relationships with these countries, right, with the promise of economic development, building out of infrastructure, and seeking these concessions that, you know, often are given under, you know, very strange circumstances. And this is partly the Panamanian case, right, where the concession to First Quantum, the Toronto-based corporation, is given in a different political reality where now that's not seen to be as acceptable. And that led to a lot of the clashes between people and the state, right, and calling the concession that was given to First Quantum Minerals back in, I believe, like 1999, giving them this concession for 20 or 30 years was seen to be like not in the best interest of the future of Panamanians and of Panama itself. And so that was considered to be an unconstitutional move. And so there was a reinterpretation of that in the present that made the Panamanian Supreme Court ruled that it was unconstitutional, but only after, right, incredible popular pressure to make the state reconsider that relationship, because there's still this kind of fixation around transnational mining companies, especially, that they are going to produce the economic future of us all. And I think that sort of myth and that fiction was really shattered by the protests and the activism that we saw in late 2023.
Yeah, this is why we have to stress again that there may be a ripple effect with this ruling, because possibly in any other part of Central America, this deal would have gone unchallenged in pretty much every government that you can think of in Central America. Even right now, it's sort of like business as usual, but it was not business as usual in Panama, which makes this all the more unique. Now, what sectors of Panamanian society joined together to protest against the government's lax deals with these mining companies, like the ones that you just mentioned? Because obviously environmentalists, students, youth movements were against this, but then you have organizations like truck drivers and teachers, you know, involved in this protest as well. Now,
yeah,
it would seem incongruous at first to think, why would truck drivers be involved in this? Because if there's anything that would pollute the country, it would be trucks. But there's more to this and a greater nuance that people need to understand.
So I want to make a quick correction. I said 1999, it was 20, like around 2013, in fact, when the concession was given. And so I just want to make that correction. But then, you know, to your question, the people who were involved, I mean, it really was, while on the streets, you could say that it was students, that it was teachers, that it was environmentalists, that it was indigenous groups, right? Human rights defenders. There were trade unions and sindicatos and workers, organizations that were on the streets. That broad coalition, like, we can't really understand the explosion of this anti-mining movement, right? And the kind of characteristics of anti-mining that it took on, the kind of environmental sensibility, without actually thinking back to 2022 and the summer of protest when Panamanians took to the streets in a similar way to speak out against the austerity and the kind of cutbacks to public education, to healthcare, right? That the government had already implemented. So that was sort of like, you know, strike one and strike two, right? In 2022. And then once you have this egregious case of, you know, this renewal of the contract for Cobre Panama, the First Quantum Minerals project, it becomes strike three. And that's like, enough is enough. So we have to really kind of put it in that longer, even it's not even that long, right? But, you know, kind of a year or two relief, right? So that we get a sense of like the overwhelming accumulation of frustrations that Panamanians were feeling already going into like a post-pandemic world that wasn't of their liking, that really wasn't adequate to the kinds of lifestyles that they've been accustomed to, right? Like, simply was a kind of divestment. The way it was perceived as a divestment from public education, from healthcare, right, from public necessities, from transportation, from roads, while there's all these, you know, concessions and, you know, lax regulations and kind of very positive economic climate for transnational corporations like First Quantum. So like that just simply did not compute to the regular Panamanian, right? So even though on the streets we saw, you know, all the sectors that I mentioned and that you mentioned, it was also really interesting that even among sort of middle class Panamanians, right, and people who actually weren't even on the streets, they were talking about it. Like, not only were they talking about the inconveniences of the protest, right, that like the truck driver stopped, the delivery stopped coming to different parts of the country, right? Panama has one main sort of artery, right? Pan-American Highway, though they call it the Inter-American Highway in Panama, yeah. right, that connects the whole country. And so if you block that, you block everything. And this is a clear sort of tactic and strategy of this like collective of people who were protesting, because they knew it would get the attention not only of the state, but also of international media, right? And it would like simply stop the actual, you know, sort of machinery of the mind to continue operating unimpeded. But what was so interesting, and I just want to say that again, that like people who were not on the streets were talking about it. So like kids at school, people who work in offices, right? People who are, you know, working in different sectors of Panamanian society, street vendors, people who work in retail, everybody was talking about it. There were opposing views, sure. Like for many, they were inconvenienced by the fact that they couldn't get gas, they couldn't get dairy, they couldn't get cheese, they couldn't get fruits and vegetables, right? So there was that part. But at the same time, there was an overwhelming understanding that the people of the righteousness of what these folks were doing, right, on the Inter-American Highway, that this struggle that they were engaged in against the copper mine was correct, was appropriate, even though they were being inconvenienced, right? Even that conversation amongst sort of middle class and office workers and folks like that was really profound and trying to see, because it shows that there's a generalized sort of sensibility and awareness that copper is not the future of Panama. If Panama considers itself to be one of the most biodiverse places on the planet, one could say that Panamanian nationalism is kind of like an environmental nationalism, right? Because they're so proud of the natural history of their country, right? That's something that's very much shared amongst everybody. And so this is why this kind of anti-mining struggle was seen to be valiant and true, right? And in the interest of everybody.
You know what? Another sector that protested against this mining contract with this Canadian firm was the agricultural sector. And for good reason, because one of the things that I think should be a crucial frame of reference, not just in the U.S. and not just in Latin America, but throughout the world when it comes to banning mining and to talk about the dangers of mining, I want to point to you the Animas River spill of 2015. It's almost insane to think that it's been almost 10 years since that happened. So in 2015, the Animas River, an abandoned gold mine, and I want to stress this, an abandoned gold mine suffered a leakage, a spill of harsh chemicals that were basically abandoned in this mine. And anyone who Googles the Animas River, even today, will find that river from 10 years ago with this fluorescent yellow gold color going for miles on this river. And the amount of damage that it did to the environment going down river, you know, it's still up for debate as to how much damage that truly caused almost 10 years later. That should be a crucial frame of reference to any anti-mining activist to show people that, hey, this could happen anywhere, including Panama, especially in Panama, when there's still a significant portion of the economy that's still dependent on agriculture, correct?
I think that's a really like apt comparison. And it's true that much of Panamanian GDP comes from farming, comes from agricultural production, right? Comes from coffee. Those are sectors with their own sort of problems and histories as well.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, right, that model, right, kind of agricultural production, production of milk, beef, right, all these kinds of things are very much a system of production that has proved tolerable by Panamanians and then has allowed for many to participate, to earn an income, right, and to exist in that kind of agricultural world. But that being said, like, even those folks who are usually sort of who own large farms and are big ranchers, right, who are typically, or one might think, are typically disassociated from popular interests because they depend on certain kind of relations of inequality, right, for agricultural exploitation, which is a sort of classical example of exploitation. Even those folks, right, were very much aware and in line with some of the protesters because they saw that their way of life, right, their way of life, the way that they've carved out a business and become part of kind of an export elite in Panama was also under threat, right? And so there's a question of sovereignty and different levels of sovereignty, right, that were experienced by the popular classes, right, which include indigenous people, working class people, Black Panamanians who have historically been left out of most of the production of country riches, right? But even these sort of agrarian elites were sort of supportive of the protesters. There was also some tension, no doubt, But in general, there was a sense of support because they could see, right, that if this mine were to go forward and this one mine might actually lead to more mining projects, similar, one might even make the argument that hydroelectric damming also is a similar sort of process, right? It would trample on what they've built and what they do and their livelihoods and impact the agricultural sector that already coming out of COVID was impacted quite heavily, right? And so it's really quite fascinating that folks who are generally sort of opposing political viewpoints and horizons, right, and have different imaginaries and understandings of what the country should be all about, really kind of focused and cohered and aligned themselves to push out this mine, right? So it wasn't simply the popular movement, but there was also people who you might think have historically opposed interests to those groups that were also part of getting this mine out of Panama, or not even getting it out, just shutting it down. Because, you know, it affects water, groundwater, it affects river water, right? Such as the example that you mentioned, right? The Animas River. There's environmental spills and damage that you just simply like incredibly difficult to get rid of, right? It kills wildlife. It kills flora and fauna. It affects like soil health. It even affects weather patterns in some cases, right? Because they destroy most of the foliage, right? And the forest cover, right? To make way for this mine and the roads and the infrastructure necessary to get to it. That like it also kind of affects the regional and microclimates of different places, which has, you know, incredible impacts that are somewhat unquantifiable, but there's an awareness by people about what this can mean, right? And so, you know, in your example of the Animas River spill, like it's precisely that. Like we don't know exactly what the damages were from that spill. There's actually like one could even talk about the San Jose mine in Chile, you know, where the miners were caved in. Another example of the violence of the mine, right? We can talk about La Escondida mine in Peru, that like in 2012, there was like a huge landslide because of these kinds of lax regulations that also come with the concessions. There's this idea that the transnational corporation operates under the best practices and they're the leaders in the sector. And so they know what they're doing. So there's never any oversight and never any regulations in place to safeguard the workers at those places, you know, in those sites. The Porvenir mine in Honduras, which is similar to the Animas spill, actually, because there was cyanide that contaminated this river, the Lara River in Honduras, right? And so while these mines were closed, the problems remained, the kind of threat, the threat of spillage, of something breaking that's containing a certain kind of toxic material, always remains, even if the mine has been, you know, sort of dormant for decades, right? And so it's kind of like this ticking time bomb. And there's so many examples, especially in like the 2010s, of mines collapsing, of spills happening, right? One of which is the Animas River spill, but in Latin America, right? And at the same time that these environmental disasters are taking place, there's also an incredible scramble by these transnational corporations like First Quantum to like go elsewhere and to open up another mine in order to continue and continue and continue and continue. The fact that Panamanians were able to like kind of halt this took a lot of political power and popular power, but also foresight and really an awareness of these other dangers. Like the examples are plentiful. We could see them, you know, right across the border in other places, you know, we could see them. And I think this really motivated and galvanized people to make their voices heard around this specific issue because it's just so extreme and egregious and dangerous and volatile, right? That it doesn't just endanger people in the present, right? But endangers like generations to come.
And I'm glad you mentioned that right now because we're going to take a break right here. But before we do, I'm glad that you mentioned Honduras because they have a similar mining industry, not to the same extent as Panama. But we have to remind ourselves that over the last 15 years alone, a lot of environmental activists have been killed in other parts of Central America for fighting for environmental justice. And so we cannot forget that because there have been a few copycats here and there with regards to reversing bans on mining in other parts of Central America, which we'll get to in a second. But before we do, we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Jorge Cuellar, who's an assistant professor of Latin American, Latino, and Caribbean Studies at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM. Washington. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned. Ruben Blades, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone, you can also follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. That is @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about the anti-mining movement in Panama and how it could affect the rest of Central America with Jorge Cuellar, who is an assistant professor of Latin American, Latino, and Caribbean Studies at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. So, Jorge, you realize that we've gone this deep into the conversation, and at no point have we mentioned the current Panamanian president, Laurentino Cortizo, who, let's be real here, is sort of a middle-of-the-road politician of almost zero consequence who would be exactly the type of politician who would sign these deals with Canadian mining firms like the one in question in Panama. And this is why we haven't mentioned, because this could have been done with any other politician, you know, who's middle of the road in Panama or anywhere else in Central America. In fact, we have to point out that in a different NACLA article on the anti-mining movement in Panama, in 2019, he initially promised not to expand mining or to give these sort of contracts to mining firms outside the country. But then the pandemic hit, and as any other part of Latin America, the economy in Panama was hit pretty hard, and he reversed his campaign promise on mining deals with companies like that of First Quantum of Canada. So again, it's one of those politicians that is of little or no consequence other than to do things that are counterproductive to the Panamanian people and the Panamanian environment. With that said, though, in the NACLA article where you were interviewed last month with Michael Fox, can you explain what is extractive time? Because I think that this concept that you brought up, it extends beyond mining. It extends beyond raw materials and natural resources. I think when it comes to an extractivist economy in places like Central America, we could even extend it to things like Starbucks or McDonald's. Because when those companies set up shop, they're doing it with the intent to make a profit. And the only way those companies can make a profit is to make assurances that that money that they make daily goes outside the country and not to the benefit of the local population. So this is sort of the definition that I got from this term, but you go ahead and expand on it, please.
Oscar, you nailed it. I mean, it's precisely the sort of, it's like the temporality of what the mine is, like real in terms of exploration, concession, operation, and then closing. So that's about like 30 to 70 years, you know, of sort of activity that a mine will produce. But that's like basically a lifetime, right? That's one lifetime. Lifespans are now a little bit longer, but more or less a lifetime. But what happens after that mine is gone, right? After that mine is gone, there's all these dangers, right, that we mentioned earlier about spillage, about poisoning land, of like lessening the productivity of those lands. All sorts of problems, right? The death of wildlife and, you know, species death and biodiversity loss, all these like kind of unquantifiable goods and valuable things of a place, right? And of an ecosystem that are totally wiped out because of this project that was conceded and that was granted with a sort of short-termism and a short-term approach, right, to economic wealth production in the short term, right? So like quarterly gains, GDP, debt, right? All these kinds of things that these projects are supposed to be solving, employment problems, right? And especially like you mentioned, coming out of a pandemic, like it was to sort of the capitalist presidential leader, Laurentino Cortizo, this seemed like a great idea, right? It was a silver bullet or a copper bullet, one might say, right? That solved a lot of problems, right? Solved a lot of economic problems from the point of view of the state in the short term, in the presidential term, in an election cycle that's coming up this year in 2024, right? So it is precisely that kind of short-term thinking that leads to these kinds of projects taking place. And so that's what I mean about extractive time, right? Extractive time is very contained. It's those 20 to 70 years. But the extractive time also creates a shatter zone, a sort of sacrifice zone around it that is something that lingers, that is residual, that sort of just stays in the ground and in the waters and in the mutations of animals, in the health problems that people might have, respiratory, all sorts of things, right? For example, kids born with cancer in places like Colombia, where incredible pesticide use, right, for the banana plantations, or for example, kids born with hearing loss in places where there's incredible machinery operating at all times, right? There's all these examples across the region of how these extractive projects, right? And we might take, that's why you mentioned Starbucks, but these kind of large scale projects that are reaping and pillaging raw materials from places like Latin America, there's all these residual harmful effects that we don't see. They're not taken account of in that initial calculation as to why this project, like Cobre Panamá, is good, right? And it's something we need. It's a need, but a very short-term need, not that long-range need. And that long-range intergenerational need is what the social movements really made clear when they said, we don't want this thing. Because they were actually really keen and really aware, right? Really precise in what they were saying, that this is actually about the future. This is actually about our kids' kid. This is not about, you know, 2024's election where a corrupt Panamanian politician like Martinelli might win, right? And then we're back to, you know, Panama Papers again, right? But yeah, they were thinking long range, right? This is not about the electoralism that we're often thinking about all the time, right? We think in those cycles too. They were thinking beyond it, right? They were thinking way, way, way ahead. And that to me is what these movements showed. They actually identified the limitations of extractive time and a rejection of something like extractive time, because it simply is something that is going to hurt people who are coming after them. And that incredible sort of, what might call it, like an intergenerational solidarity, right? For people who are coming in the future, is such an important move, right? That pushes back against this sense by transnational corporations and, you know, presidential leaders that are sitting at like the Bloomberg conference, you know, room talking with other economic councils and journalists about like what Panama can provide to the global economy. Like, this was Cortizo's like approach from the beginning. So they're not thinking with that anymore. They don't care about that, in the sense that like what those presidential leaders will produce are these short-term projects. And they're thinking way, way, way beyond them. And so that was one of the like the main things that these movements really showed, that like extractive time has no value any longer. That's not a scale at which we are comfortable thinking any longer, because we know, and we're not going to be lied to. We have so many counterexamples of how like, yeah, this might produce, you know, 200 jobs in the present. It might give us, you know, some sense of economic dynamism for a little while.
Yeah.
But in the long term, we're losing like invaluable, unquantifiable things that compose the worlds that we're from.
Yeah. And I'll take it a step further, that this extractive time that you mentioned also undermines democracy. This free movement of capital undermines democracy, because going back to the Starbucks analogy, any $1 cup of coffee that Starbucks sells in, say, for example, El Salvador, you know, if 60 cents of that cup of coffee goes straight to Starbucks, which is based here in the US, that 60 cents made from that $1 is not going back to the country. And that 60 cents accumulates, considering how much business they do in a country like El Salvador and in a region like Central America. Those 60 cents could have been used for public education, healthcare, transportation, infrastructure, retirement, et cetera, et cetera. And it's not being used as such. And it's the almost centuries long now battle against U.S. corporate interests in places like Central America. And I'm hoping, as you just described, that people are becoming more aware of this and putting more of the dots together of how these companies, you know, extract not just the raw materials, but also the economic future of the country as a result. Now, going back to the protests that led to this court ruling in late November, early December, can you tell us, if you can, what was the police response to peaceful demonstrators in late October, early December? Because as one could imagine, the police response being what it is, we are talking about Central America, of course. Panama doesn't have the same political violent history as, say, Honduras or Guatemala, but nonetheless, peaceful demonstrations oftentimes are met with police force.
It was really violent and repressive, basically. Like, there are many people who were detained for peaceful protests. There were clashes also with, you know, more active protesting that was happening in the streets of Panama City and on the Inter-American Highway, where, like, you know, protesters would clash with police and there was tear gas thrown. I remember seeing these videos of Molotovs were being thrown. It was kind of intense, right? And many people were injured. And this is this is not okay, right? There were tires that were being burned on the street. You know, the blocked roads would create a lot of clashes between people who are trying to get somewhere and the activities of the protesters. I remember that one video, and I'm sure you've seen this, of that white American expat, this old man, right, who is going towards David Chiriqui in the eastern part of the country, or in the western part of the country, sorry. And he literally just gets out of his car and then shoots like two or three people who are protesting on the road simply because he felt that the police weren't doing enough, right? That they weren't doing enough to get rid of these protesters, and they were complicating his travel, and he was losing money, right? And all sorts of issues that counter protesters, if you want to call him one of those, were raising. And so there were like intense clashes that way too, like interpersonal clashes between different sectors of Panamanian society, right? Expats are huge in Panama. There's so many of them, right? Because of the historical occupation of the United States, of the Canal Zone, right, in Panama City, and the various military bases that were littered throughout the country, right? So there are many people from other places like the United States and Canada and Europe, right, who are there. And that when they encounter these protests, they're like, why are you making my life difficult, right? Without really trying to understand precisely why these folks are organized, why these folks are protesting. And the police was very much, you know, sometimes in line with those counter protesters in terms of forcefully moving people out of the way, right, in order to let gasoline trucks, right, make it through, or different livestock to make it through, right, things like this that led to a lot of clashes between people. And there are reports of folks who are still in jail and have been detained because of this. And so there were many human rights violations. And so in that sense, right, there, it's not that dissimilar from what we see in other countries, right? That anytime there is a sort of social presence around anti-mining, right, the state, transnational capital, you'll have, you know, the goons show up and try to manage that, right?
Exactly. And again, let's reiterate, the Supreme Court ruled that this was unconstitutional, this contract between the Panamanian government and the Canadian mining firm. But despite that ruling, as you just mentioned, people are still in jail right now on whatever charges, who knows? And it has to be stressed again that hopefully this will have a ripple effect in the rest of Central America. Guatemala has historically been hostile towards not only environmentalists, but indigenous and Afro-Guatemalans who have pushed for environmental justice. The issue of reopening mining in El Salvador is also problematic, to say the least, with the current authoritarian government of Nayib Bukele there, and how he is seemingly criminalizing people who won these anti-mining legislation legally almost 2 decades ago. And Honduras, during the coup government, just straight up went after and just straight up killed environmental activists altogether, full stop. So in the 5 minutes that we have left, and once again, we're going to create a link to this NACLA interview with you that Michael Fox did in NACLA so people can learn more. But in these final 5 minutes, you know, what other components of this issue would you like people to learn about? Because again, this goes beyond just the Cortizo government. This goes beyond just Panama, just beyond Central America as well. Because if these battles can be fought legally and the Supreme Court can side it, then hopefully that this would awaken the rest of the body politic of whichever country that we're talking about here.
It's a complicated reality, right? Because some places, right, there's a political class that is really convincing about these kind of short-term projects, and they push them down people's throat, right? They sell them on employment. They sell them on, you know, we're going to build you a school. We're going to build you a better road, right? And so those are really urgent needs to many communities, and we can't discount that. But what we need to be really cognizant of and really aware of is the fact that these kinds of solutions create more problems than they actually are resolving, right? And I need people to really see this, right, and identify this for themselves in the mobilizations in Panama, because they're really teaching us a lesson, and they're really giving us a kind of political education of like the way that we can put a stop to this kind of sort of extractive mania, right, that is taking over most of Latin America.
Extractive mania, that's a good one.
It really is really maniacal of what's happening, right? And so thinking back to the El Salvador case, right, in 2017, where social movements won a total ban on metallic mining in the country, that was an important victory, no doubt. But already El Salvador's rivers were polluted beyond repair, right? So it was a little bit too late. Like, even though it was an incredible victory, right? And gold mining specifically, and this is also another Canadian company, right? Pacific Rim Mining, Oceana Gold. It was a little bit too late because much of the damage was already done, right? But what the Panamanians have shown us is that we can actually get this done right at the beginning, right at the beginning, because that mine, the Cobre Panama, had only been operating since 2019, right? And so it's like, we can really like see that we can nip this in the bud or as close to the bud as possible. And I think that's one of the incredible lessons of the Panamanian uprising against the Cobre Panama mine, in the sense that like you can mobilize different sectors that have, one might say, have nothing in common or not too many things in common with one another, to see the long-term vision of why mining is a useless endeavor. It's about the use value of a mine. The use value of a mine is going to be gone in a lifetime when, you know, the use value of this incredible volcano, this incredible valley, this incredible, you know, biodiverse forest. In fact, they just uncovered this really ancient ecosystem in Panama. I just read the news, you know, a few days ago. And so it's that kind of stuff that is just intangible heritage, right? And that intangible heritage is what is at stake in these struggles, right? And in addition to, right, not only that intangible heritage, which is a right for us all, you know, as a species, but like also indigenous cultures, right, ways of life that have been carved out in those kinds of environments. And those folks are the first people to be displaced, are the first people to be disappeared by hired guns, by these companies, right, who often play dirty, who often play in that kind of legal gray area to get their way. And we know this very clearly from El Salvador, from Honduras, from Colombia, from Ecuador. Like, we know this already. And so, like, the Panamanian case actually shows us that, like, we can avoid all that stuff, right? We can avoid all that stuff if we mobilize right at the beginning, right? And that we organize against these interests, right? Using not only the instruments of the state that are already there, right? As fraught as they may be. Democracy in Latin America is a very complex and often very limited instrument for doing social good, because it's corrupted, because it's co-opted, right? Because it includes mostly representatives and interests of a particular social class, right? But by using those instruments, by using the legal instruments, and at the same time, mobilizing on the streets, right? And cooperating and being in solidarity with different sectors in society, in civil society, and across, you know, difference, right? Black groups, indigenous groups, mestizo groups, doing that, like one of the most important lessons of this moment. And that I hope that when people, you know, sort of think and reflect on what happened in Panama, like they see the relevance, right, and the resonance of that movement and that of that ongoing movement against these extractive projects, not only as like a short-term fix for something that's problematic, but really something that's pointing us to a different like version and a different vision of what our countries can be, and the way that we can play really key roles, very different and diverse sets of roles, but key roles, right, in making those futures more of a possibility.
So we should also remind people that this Supreme Court ruling in Panama is not the end of a journey, but at the very least serves as a reminder that there are other components of society, in this case, Panamanian society, that has essentially become a legalized form of theft, not just in the environment, not just in the Panama Papers, but things that will invariably affect the future of the country as well. And so hopefully, at the very least, with this ruling, that people in other parts of the region will wake up as well. So in the meantime, we've been speaking with Jorge Cuellar, who's an assistant professor of Latin American, Latino, and Caribbean Studies at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. So Jorge, as always, it's a pleasure. It's fun. Thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on again, Oscar. There's more to say, but, you know, we'll continue at some other time.
Absolutely. No problem at all. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. That is @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for being on the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
The best in live music entertainment is coming to Bethesda Theater. Peebo Bryson, the legendary voice of love, for two big shows on Friday, January 26th at 8:30 p.m. and Saturday, January 27th at 8 p.m. Celebrate legend Bob Marley at the annual One Love Birthday Bash featuring popular reggae band I and I Rhythm on Saturday, February 3rd at 8 p.m. Celebrate more love at the Quiet Storm Valentine Celebration featuring live performances of classic love songs on Saturday, February 10th at 8 p.m. Peebo Bryson on January 26th and 27th. Bob Marley, the birthday bash on February 3rd, and Quiet Storm Valentine Celebration on February 10th. More info and tickets at BethesdaTheater.com. WPFW is a proud media partner with Bethesda Theater.
I'm Jackie Lukeman.
Peace. I'm Sean Blackman.
and we're the hosts of Darker Than Blue, your number one source for struggle, socialism, and soul.
We explore people's movements, news, politics, music, and culture from a perspective that you won't hear from the bought and paid for corporate media.
This is a show by the movement and for the movement. So we don't just want you to listen. We want you to get involved in the effort to change the world for the better.
So check us out every Friday at 5 p.m. beginning January 5th on Pacifica Radio's WPFW.
Building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York. I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. Congress approved a stopgap funding bill yesterday, sending the bill to President Biden for an expected signature and avoiding a partial government shutdown that was due to begin at midnight tonight. The Senate first approved the measure in a 77-18 vote, and the House followed suit later in the day with a 314-108 vote. Nearly all the no votes yesterday were from Republicans. The measure extends current funding levels to early March, giving congressional negotiators more time to iron out full-year funding plans. A small group of far-right House Republicans attempted to force a government shutdown over their demands for deep spending cuts, and that group may again seek to derail negotiations in the coming weeks. Families of victims in the 2022 Uvalde, Texas school shooting are renewing calls for criminal charges following a scathing Justice Department report that skewered police for failing to respond to the shooting. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland called the lethargic police response, quote, a failure that should not have happened. A separate criminal investigation by Uvalde County prosecutors remains unfinished. Several cops have lost their jobs since the shooting, but none have been charged. DA Christina Mitchell initially said that she hoped to bring the case before a grand jury last year, but pushed back that date last month. She said yesterday that she needs more time to review the DOJ report. Newsroom workers at the Los Angeles Times are staging a one-day walkout today in response to anticipated layoffs as the paper struggles financially. The LA Times Guild called the planned layoffs significant and said today's work stoppage is the first in the paper's 143-year history. Journalists at the paper reported that the layoffs could impact at least 100 staffers, or about 20% of the newsroom. Newsrooms in the U.S. have struggled financially for years as new forms of media and advertising undercut the industry. Taiwan's envoy to the United States said in an AP interview today that the island's new president will seek to maintain the status quo in the Taiwan Strait, seeking to reassure the U.S. and China that tensions will not escalate. The envoy said the new government wants, quote, the way it is, neither unification, neither independence, end quote. The Taiwanese election on Saturday returned the ruling Democratic Progressive Party to power for a third term with a new party leader at its head. China has referred to the ruling party as pro-independence and has vowed to reunite Taiwan with mainland China in the future. The NATO military alliance is set to hold its largest exercise since the Cold War, with about 90,000 troops due to join drills that run through May. The exercises are intended to practice maneuvers by U.S. troops to reinforce NATO's eastern borders. More than 50 naval vessels and scores of fighter jets, tanks, and other vehicles will be used. NATO strategic documents explicitly name Russia as the alliance's top threat, and last year, alliance leaders produced detailed defense plans against a potential Russian invasion. And a near-total communications blackout in Gaza has now entered its second week with no signs of abating. The lack of internet and cell phone service leaves civilians unable to call for help and leaves aid workers struggling to reach them. The blackout also means that Palestinians both in and outside Gaza have no way of knowing whether family members from whom they are separated are alive or dead. Palestinian internet provider Paltel said the blackout is the longest of several that Gaza has endured since the beginning of the war, and said it was the result of damaged infrastructure in the southern city of Khan Yunis. Yesterday, Politico quoted a White House official